Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 6th. I'm Ray Graff. What an astronomy month we have had. We had the most beautiful comet that we could see in the last couple of decades, NEOWISE, starting to fade now. Perseid meteor shower is on the way. It's going on now, but it'll be very good next week, I am told. There is much to discuss, and to discuss it, we have two astronomers with us on the line, Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. And they are here to answer your questions about space, constellations, comets, anything else in the final frontier. Give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, your astronomy calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers on the line today to answer your questions about the heavens. Bob Berman is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. He is the author of a whole bunch of very interesting books. Dr. Valerie Rapson is the chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at the Rochester Institute of Technology, a new gig coming up, which we'll talk about in a moment. The number to call if you have a question about astronomy, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number here on this call-in program, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ray. Good to be here.
Thank you. Yes, always happy to join you.
Valerie Rapson, you have a new job coming up.
I do. So unfortunately, I'm going to be leaving the capital region, but I'm not going that far. I'm just shifting about an hour west. And I actually just took a job as an assistant professor at SUNY Oneonta in their physics and astronomy department. So I'll be teaching there, helping with the planetarium and their little science museum once all of that can reopen. So I'm really excited about the new job, but of course sad to shift away from the capital region a little bit.
Well, thankfully, since we haven't had a guest in the studio in about 6 months, we'll still be able to have you on the show via the telephone.
Oh, for sure.
If you'll do it. Bob Berman, what's happening, man?
Well, yeah, great. The new observatory here in Willow outside of Woodstock is a lot of fun. It's mostly private. I don't give the college classes that I used to at the old one. But boy, midnight last night, just seeing Saturn with ring inside of ring. I mean, beauty really is the bottom line in astronomy, I think, for me, even after all these years.
You know, we have been going back and forth a little bit via email today. There's so much to talk about, so I thought we would run down some of the news, and then we'll take a quick break and then hit the phones. The number to call is 800-348-2551. All right, first two items. I know these are not technically astronomy items, but I was absolutely stuck to the TV because it's the first time in 45 years I have seen this. Two NASA astronauts return to Earth in a dramatic retro-style splashdown. The SpaceX, I believe it was the Dragon?
The Crew Dragon, yep.
Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken parachuted down into the Gulf of Mexico near Pensacola, Florida. It was so cool to see. Those of us of a certain age remember watching all of those Apollo shots come back down and land in the, or not land, but certainly splash down in the ocean. Pretty exciting stuff, Valerie.
Yeah, it was super cool. I watched it on the laptop and was cheering them on the whole time. It's great that we're finally sending our astronauts back to the space station from our own soil. It's wonderful to see SpaceX taking the lead. And I'm just so glad that everything worked out. It happened without a hitch.
It went pretty well.
Yeah, because it could happen with a hitch. We remember that Gus Grissom in his Mercury capsule, infamously it sunk, and there was always controversy. Did he do something wrong? Did he blow the hatch? Did he let seawater in? And probably an unfair criticism, because he said, no, it just did it on its own, but he just barely escaped with his life. So it just shows these are courageous people, and anything can happen at any point, really.
And then SpaceX launched a prototype, I believe, yesterday or the day before of its Mars rocket ship. It only went 500 feet up into the air, but it was really cool to see. I don't know if either of you caught that one.
I saw that one, too. It was really neat. This one, it wasn't designed to go very far up on Earth, but once it's on Mars with lower gravity and less atmosphere, this is the type of craft we can use to get people off the surface of Mars and back into an orbiting craft to come home. So we're just doing the basic testing here on Earth, but it'll work a lot better on Mars once we get there.
Yep, sooner or later.
And Bob Berman is against it, though, right?
No, not against it. I mean, we get a lot more bang for the buck with remote and robotic craft than we do with manned craft. We get a lot more science, and it's a lot less money. So just those who say, well, though we have enough problems on Earth, should we really be spending that kind of money? For those people, then the answer is yes. Do we really need these manned craft? But for the romantics, yeah, among us, which includes, I think, present company, the idea of some of us, representative humans, being actually able to walk on another planet, which we've never done, well, yeah, who could be against that, really?
All right. Well, you know, speaking of unmanned spacecraft, NASA's Juno spacecraft orbits Jupiter, I should say, and it discovered lightning in the planet's upper atmosphere, which I thought was very cool.
Yeah, it was really neat. We've only seen lightning on Jupiter in the lower levels of the atmosphere, but now we've seen it in the upper level atmosphere. And it turns out that the water is probably mixing with the ammonia and stopping it from freezing near the surface. And it can actually trigger lightning storms on the surface.
So there's a lot of ammonia slush on Jupiter is the upshot of this.
Yeah, basically.
All right, and then there's one more, and then there are a couple of things that Bob mentioned. By the way, the number to call if you have an astronomy question for Bob Berman or Valerie Rapson, 800-348-2551. There was an item in Science Daily, and it said, using the super sharp radio vision of the National Science Foundation's continent-wide very long baseline array, astronomers have discovered a Saturn-sized planet closely orbiting a small, cool star 35 light-years from Earth. Not so much interested in the Saturn-sized planet orbiting the star, although I suspect our guests are, but I'm more interested in this continent-wide VLBA. Could one of you talk about that?
Well, go ahead, Bob.
I'll just do a little bit, and I think Valerie may know more about it than I will, but just in general, the larger the array, it's kind of contradictory, it seems, at first glance, the finer the detail or sharpness that you can get. I mean, amateur backyard astronomers know that the larger the diameter of your lens or mirror means that's the smaller, finer detail that you can get, and that works with everything. So if you really want to be able to resolve something like a planet going around another star, you need big. And in the last couple of decades, the way to get big is you combine the capabilities of several different telescopes, either optical, in the case of interferometry, or radio telescopes that are far apart, and then electronically combine the signals so it acts as if it's a single, much larger instrument, and therefore can get the kind of resolution that you couldn't from a single instrument. Is that okay, what I said, Valerie?
Yeah, that's exactly right. These are a bunch of radio dishes scattered across the country. I think there's 10 of them, and they're like 80 feet wide or so each. So they're big radio dishes on their own. But when they talk to each other and you combine the information to create a single image, as Bob said, you get much higher resolution, much better detail. And you don't have to build a telescope as big as the continent,
right,
or as big as the country. You just put all the data together, and it happens.
Well, that's convenient. I'll tell you what, there is a great list of upcoming events and sort of passing events. We're talking about NEOWISE, the comet that is sort of fading now, that Bob sent earlier. And we don't have time now. We'll take a quick break. Then we'll run down this list that Bob sent, which is very interesting. Then we'll hit the phones and the email bag. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. We're joined today by Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. It's Astronomy Today. 800-348-2551 is the number. And before we get to the email and the phones, Bob, I got to tell you, you know, I've often said, jokingly, but truly, that I can't use a telescope. I can't find the moon. I couldn't find a telephone pole down the street with one. But we got out our binoculars a couple weeks ago, and everyone in my family, we stood and our jaws dropped because Comet Neowise was spectacular.
I'm so glad you saw that, you and your family, Ray. I'm so glad you did. And the people who did saw the finest comet in 23 years. And then there were others who tried, give them credit, but the weather was either cloudy or hazy for them, or they lived too far inside of the city, but give them credit. And then there were people who, I guess, either didn't care or just were not aware of it. So it was all over the place. But for those who did look in the right place, and it was easy because it was right under the Big Dipper at 10 o'clock, especially through binoculars. Ray, you're so right. Our jaws dropped also. Valerie, did you get to see it?
I did. And I was fortunate enough to be able to see it right from my apartment complex. And this was my first naked eye comet ever, because 23 years ago I was too young to care about comets. So I had never seen one with my own eyes before. And it was spectacular. And let me tell you, I had to resist the urge to run around to all of the doors in my complex and start knocking on the doors to tell people, you have to come outside. You have to look at the comet. Because that's what I wanted to do. And I had to breathe and be like, you know, there's a pandemic. They're going to think you're weird if you do that. Just enjoy it yourself. But it was really spectacular.
Yeah, and for those who did see it, let me add that there's something about comets, and this is outside of science. I mean, Valerie, with her PhD, is, you know, has studied math and physics, but comets, there's something about their feeling, their flavor, their vibe. I know vibe is, I live near Woodstock, so that's the kind of language that we use around here. But there's a feeling to comets that is quite different from seeing, let's say, a planet or a star or even the aurora. And sure enough, through the centuries, people who have observed naked eye comets have usually been fearful, but it's always had evoked a feeling that is very different from any other celestial object. So those who saw it, especially enhanced by binoculars, now understand what all the big deal about comets is about. You have to see it. A photograph won't convey it. But when you see it for yourself, as Ray said, your jaw drops and you go, ah! It takes your breath away.
You know, and it's funny. Once you saw it, you know, we have a fair amount of light pollution where we live, but once you saw it with the binoculars, and I said, okay, just line it up with Eileen's chimney, the kids, and they lined it up and they could see it. Once you saw it, then you could see it with the naked eye very easily. And we got into a very interesting conversation about the rods and cones in your eye and how if you look sideways at it, you could see it better at night. And that's another show. But it was really cool. And you also mentioned, Bob, that the Perseid meteor shower is underway, but it'll be really good next week.
Yeah, and this ties in because meteor showers all are debris that come from comets. And so, which is why meteors are in the meteor showers are icy, because comets are icy, and why absolutely none of them has a chance of making it through the atmosphere and surviving as a meteorite that somebody might pick up, because comet debris is fragile and can't make its way through the atmosphere. So they're very much tied together. And because the moon is not going to be near full, this is one of those years that the shower should be quite nice. And I would go for two nights, the night of August 11th and the night of August 12th. So you really have two opportunities for it. And if you're away from the lights of town, if you're not stuck downtown somewhere, you should be able to see at least one every 2 minutes.
Very cool. All right, listen, let's take a call here, and then we will get back to some of the things on this list. 800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman is here. Valerie Rapson is here. It's Astronomy Today. Mary is in Albany. Mary, you're on.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I am lucky enough, I swim at night around midnight
out in Slingerland. And the sky is very clear, usually. There's not a lot of light pollution. And I can see all the constellations very clearly, and it's amazing. Sadly, I did not see the comet. I don't know if it was too late by the time I got out. But either way, there always seems to be in the background like a swirl of, can you see the Milky Way with the naked eye? Is that a dumb question?
Not a dumb question at all.
No, you absolutely see it. And around that time, the middle of the night, midnight, that's when the Milky Way would be quite prominent at this time of year. Okay. Yes.
Oh, okay. Because it's sort of like just not, is it like a haze sort of? It's like a wave in the background almost.
It looks like a glowing stream, a very faint milky color. That's where it got its name from the Galileo and others at the time called it Via Galactica, Latin for Milk Street, Milk Avenue, because they thought it looked milky. So you're absolutely right. That's the look. And when you realize that you're seeing our own galaxy that we're trapped inside of, so we get a worm's eye view, which is shaped, since it's flat like a pancake, we're looking through the thick part of the galaxy, and that's what that Milky Way is. We're looking at our own galaxy sideways from our interior position. So quite beautiful, and should not be underrated. You're expressing something that I found now in decades of leading astronomy tours around the world, that when people get to a place that's truly dark, away from lights, Death Valley or the Atacama Desert of Chile, see the Milky Way from a truly dark site, it is not inferior to any other celestial object. Saturn's rings through a telescope, all the other beautiful things in the universe. It's hard to top the Milky Way from a truly dark site. It is just simply gorgeous, as you can attest.
Mary, thank you very much for the call. A few emails here, and then we'll get back to the phones. Bob Berman is here. Valerie Rapson is here. 800-348-2551 is the number. This email came in before the show began, and this is from Rich in New Jersey. When Mars is bright in the sky, as it was last month, it shines with an obvious red glow even to the naked eye. I wonder if we know what Earth looks like from Mars. Does it have a color, blue, white? Is Earth the brightest thing in the Martian night sky, or is it Jupiter or Saturn? And let's go to Valerie on that.
That's a great question. So there are actually pictures of Earth taken by the Mars rover on the surface of Mars. You can look those up and try and get a sense of what we'd see. Earth, I mean, we've got a lot of colors on Earth, but really I think it would look more white just because they're all going to be blended together and you're getting that reflection off of the clouds and the atmosphere. So if you were standing on Mars looking at Earth, it'd probably be fairly bright and look a little bit more white. I don't know how it would compare to the other planets. Do you have a thought on that one, Bob?
Oh, yeah. Well, the big difference is that from Mars, Earth is an inferior planet. So from Mars, you're looking sort of toward the sun to see Earth. And so it's analogous when we're seeing Venus. So from Mars, Earth goes through phases, like it can be a crescent. Whereas from Earth, Mars can never be a crescent. So what you see really largely depends upon whether you're on a planet that's looking out away from the sun or toward it. So Earth is toward the sun from Mars, and that keeps us from ever being as bright as it could be, because we never see from Mars, you'd never see a full Earth, for example, that's reflecting its light straight back. However, from Mars, you would see Jupiter. Jupiter's a bit closer from Mars than it is from here. It's about 4 astronomical units. So Jupiter would be the brightest planet as seen from Mars, and Earth would be second place.
All right, this one's from Hanny, and Hanny writes, how do I choose a telescope for home? Would like to save images of planets. I'm a senior and now use binoculars.
Well, that's a big question. Yeah, and Valerie and I have even had food fights over this. Valerie probably correctly believes that for just a few $100 these days, you can get a decent enough telescope that shows you very nice things, and she's right about that. My hesitation is that if the telescope's tripod is at all wobbly, or if the optics are just a little bit too small so that you cannot see the individual stars in those beautiful star cities called globular clusters, well, you might, after just 6 months or a year, want a bigger telescope. And it's like people who have boats. They always seem to want a slightly larger boat in the future. So my feeling is almost, hey, just save the money and start off with something that'll give you a lifetime of pleasure and get a large enough instrument that you can see a lot, and make sure it has a motor that'll follow the objects in the sky so that you don't have to keep nudging the telescope every 30 seconds or every minute as the Earth rotates. However, the larger the telescope, the better the mount, the more money. These days, a lot of people are into refractors because they're hassle-free. You don't have to adjust, collimate the mirrors that you do on the other types of telescopes periodically. But the wonderful new refractors are thousands of dollars to get a good one. So that's why there's no simple answer, and why Valerie might be right after all that. Start off reasonably.
Look at that.
And you know, you will see the rings of Saturn, the craters on the moon. You'll see fabulous things with even a small telescope. And then see if you develop a serious and continued interest in astronomy that justifies going all in.
All right. Valerie, you want to add to that before we do one more email here?
Sure. I mean, I'm always a big proponent of the Dobsonian-style telescopes because they have a nice solid wooden base. You can set it up in 30 seconds. It's pretty easy to use. So the person can take a look at different types of Dobsonians. They're really easy. And Bob is not wrong in what he's saying. If you're going to get serious about this and you want to stay out all night long and look at the stars, you're going to want a telescope that's computerized, that'll track, so you don't have to constantly adjust it. So for starters, I go with the Dobbs, the smaller telescopes. But if you think you're going to get serious, maybe you want to save up some money and go more Bob's route.
All right, last email here. Well, we have several, but a last one for now, and then we'll get back to the phones. 800-348-2551. This is from Jonathan in East Chatham. Jonathan says, I cannot get my head around the idea of the universe expanding. I asked a similar question before. Where is the universe expanding from? And if it is expanding, why do the stars and the constellations not appear to move farther apart from each other? And that's from Jonathan.
Can I tackle that first? Yeah, because the simple thing is that it's not everything is not expanding. The expanding is only a large scale effect. So that within smaller objects, and galaxies are hardly small objects, but within each galaxy, there is no expansion. The gravity wins out there, and a galaxy like our own Milky Way, the stars in our galaxy, we're talking about 400 billion of them, are not getting farther apart, and we're hanging together, so the constellations reasonably stay the same in a reasonable amount of time, and we see no trace of expansion. And in fact, within a cluster of galaxies, we live in a cluster of about 30 galaxies, we're not expanding from the other galaxies. In fact, our nearest spiral galaxy neighbor, Andromeda, is coming toward us at 70 miles per second. Not only is it not expanding, it may collide with us someday. So what's expanding? Groups of galaxies are expanding away from other groups of galaxies. And since there is no group of galaxies that you can even see when you look in the night sky without instrumentation, there's no trace of this expansion, which is maybe one reason it wasn't really discovered until the 1920s.
Valerie.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to grasp. And as Bob said, it's really the space between the groups of galaxies that's expanding. It's space that's stretching, not so much galaxies moving. And you know exactly why and how the space is stretching? Well, scientists are still trying to wrap their heads around that, too. So
we're still trying to figure it out. Wrap your head around the idea that, no,
it's
the
so
galaxies
hard.
Aren't moving. Space itself is inflating. Now, if space is emptiness, the idea that emptiness gets larger on its own, what the heck is that supposed to mean?
I don't know. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll just take a call, and we'll let that one lie. 800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is here. Valerie Rapson, 800-348-2551. Mark in Salem. Hello, Mark.
Hi. You really have blown my wig off.
Oh, really? What kind of wig do you have?
No, I've got all my hair, but it's just like my hair stood on end. I was going to ask a question, but let me preface it by saying I'll jump in on the telescope argument.
All right.
I think that Valerie's right. I don't own a 12-inch Dobsonian, but my friend does, and he brings it up from Schenectady up north. And the other night we went out to look at the comet when the ground was dry, the temperature, the air was probably 9.5 out of 10 for steadiness. And we used stabilized binoculars that he owned, 35 by 12s. And we looked at that's first I saw the comet and the only time because it clouded up. But I wanted to compare it to the Comet Bennett from 1970. At March 1970. That was the year I started astronomy.
And you saw Comet Bennett?
Yes.
Good for you. So did I. That's great. We're Pisons then in that.
I took pictures with it with my parents' Polaroid camera with a 3000 ASA black and white film.
Hmm. Lovely comet. It was passing through Taurus at that time, I think. It was just, boy, you don't hear about Bennett too much. People talk about Comet West in March of 1976, and I think West was...
I couldn't see it for where I was. It was either dark or cloudy or whatever, but...
It was cloudy a lot for West, unfortunately.
Hmm. But Comet Bennett was, I thought, similar to this comet. The ion tail and the dust trail were close together with a very slight darkness in between. And if you want to explain what that is, that'd be something people might want to know about, the difference between that.
Okay.
And Valerie, do you know the story of the Pandora, the asteroid or that Blandina Dudley discovered?
I know a little bit about it, but maybe you can share some more.
Well, Abraham Lincoln was involved too. The American Society of Science was chaired by the president, and the Dudley Observatory got into such problems with management that they ended up appealing to that board, and Lincoln sat down on the decision and gave the permission to the board to do what they wanted to do and not stay out of the public, stay out of their affairs. And when they found the new asteroid, they asked Blandina if she would name the new asteroid, and she called it Pandora.
Ah, excellent.
1863. Cool. It's in Benjamin Boss's book.
I'll tell you what, Mark, thank you for the call. We really have to take a break here,
or our
management will make life miserable for me. Let's take a break right now. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman on the line, Valerie Rapson on the line. It's astronomy. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson at Bob Berman, Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. And we will get to the phones in a moment here. Elaine in Albany, hang in there. You'll be next. We had this email from David in Rotterdam. And David wants Valerie's recommendation on that $300 telescope she mentioned a few weeks ago. What was that, Valerie?
Yeah, so this is what we buy for the students that we train. They're from Orion Telescope. So it's a 6-inch, I think it's a 6-inch classic Dobsonian is technically what they call it.
Yeah.
But if you check out Orion Telescope's website and just look up Dobsonians, they have a bunch of different sizes. And the 6-inch we buy is about $300. They have bigger ones for a little more money, smaller ones for a little less. But the 6-inch is perfect.
Okie doke. And then one other thing related to the Perseids, Bob, before we get to Elaine's call. You, in your notes, said, the Perseids source is the Swift-Tuttle comet, which we talked about. But then you have this line that says it's the most hazardous object to human life in the entire universe. Could you explain that in a moment or two?
Oh, no.
Well, yes, because when Lewis Swift and Horace Tuttle, I always want to see if I can remember their names, two Civil War astronomers, these were famous guys back then. They were like the Neil deGrasse Tyson of their time. And the same week, in July of 1862, they found this comet. Turned out it has a 133-year orbit. When it next came back in the 1990s, it was a bad apparition. Nobody got to see it at that time. I mean, it was not naked eye. But
Right. Anyway,
they found the comet, and they found that it has exactly the same orbit as each of these chunks of debris that gives us our beloved annual Perseid meteor shower. So we realized from that point on that this Perseid shower that's been observed for thousands of years by the ancient Chinese, that's its origin, this
Right. Comet
Swift-Tuttle. But that wasn't the end of the story, because we found that Swift-Tuttle has two weird things associated with it. One, it's synchronized with Jupiter. It's been manipulated by Jupiter's gravity so that it goes around the sun once in exactly the same time that Jupiter orbits the sun 11 times. So they're matched together. But worse, this big comet has the potential to come very close to Earth so that sooner or later it may collide with us.
Hmm.
And the worst news of all is that its orbit is opposite to ours. It's a retrograde orbit, so that it comes in around the sun head on. If it collides with us, it'll be a head on collision. And this explains why these Perseid meteors are so fast. They're among the fastest meteors of all at 37 miles a second. It's about 80 times faster than a high velocity rifle bullet. So that's the speed that Comet Swift-Tuttle would hit us. It would be worse than the extinction that did the dinosaurs in 66 million years ago. So it's been called, some astronomers have called it, the most hazardous object to human health of any object in the whole universe. So fortunately, as we look into the future, there doesn't seem to be any collisions in store, at least not for the next 1,000 or 2,000 years.
Okay, and we'll all be dead by then. Except Alan, who will still be running the station. Let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Elaine in Albany. Elaine, you're on.
I want to thank you so much for giving me the opportunity in the 100th year of my life, the widow of a scientist who succeeded Dr. Herman Lepofsky, this is Dr. Edward Simons, in the fuel cell program that sent Gemini into space. I have a letter from Commander Collins of the lunar module thanking Dr. Simons and the staff of NASA GE for bringing them back to Earth safely. It's the first time I've ever had the pleasure and the appreciation to give credit to scientists who suffer terribly the possibility that anything will go wrong in providing the vehicles for these expeditions. I thank you so much for helping me to give credit to the people who make possible the splashdowns, and thank you for your program. I've loved it always.
Oh, goodbye. Elaine, thank you so much for that call. We appreciate it very much. That's a nice thing to say, and thank you. If you want to call us, give us a shout now, 800-348-2551. This email came in from Frank, and Frank simply wants to know, why did it take so long to finally get a microphone on a Mars probe?
That's a good question, right? So I guess microphones and trying to hear sounds was not so much a priority up until this point. There were so many other things that we wanted to figure out and take pictures of that I think it just wasn't top of the list. It's not that it's a bad idea. We just hadn't done it yet.
I mean, what sort of things could you learn by having a microphone on a Mars probe?
Well, I don't think we're, trying to listen for aliens or anything like that. But I think you could pick up some sounds from weather patterns, stuff like that. That's what I would envision you hearing, because there's not a lot going on the surface.
Bob?
Not a lot to listen to, at least.
Yes, the Martian atmosphere is only 1% as thick as ours. And as you know, air is what propagates sound. In the vacuum of space, there could be no sound. So you need some sort of medium for sound to go through. Sound really is just a disturbance in a medium, whether it's railroad tracks that get clanked by a hammer or anything else. So yes, on Mars, with that thin air,
the sounds would be greatly subdued. On the other hand, the winds are much stronger on Mars than they are here, so you'd need something like an 80-mile-per-hour gust to even equal an 8-mile-per-hour a slight breeze on Earth. So the sounds would be a little bit more challenging.
Okay. This one's from Eric in Ulster County. I'm wondering if you can recommend a publication that can help a novice stargazer know where to look and when. Any suggestions are appreciated. And that's from Eric in Ulster County.
Well, I'd say Astronomy Magazine, of course, one of the magazines I'm associated with since I'm contributing editor, because that has lots of stuff, both professional and amateur, and star maps every issue. And even though this is like embarrassingly blowing my own horn, I'd have to save my first book. Since it got me on the Letterman show, I mean, he liked the book, Secrets of the Night Sky, would be a good beginner's book of how to see amazing things in the sky without any instrumentation.
Valerie.
Well, I agree. There's tons of good books out there, and it's hard to just pick one, but the Astronomy Magazine and Sky and Telescope Magazine, they have great starter star charts and everything like that. So those are the easiest. And then, you know, there's so many stargazing books, it's hard to pick a favorite.
Okay, this one's from Matt, and then we'll get back to the phones until the end of the program. 800-348-2551 if you want to jump in here. This one's from Matt at Prescott Observatory. Matt writes, I have a problem with infinity. It's a word that gets thrown around a lot in our society. Recently, a few measurements of the topology of the universe have shown the shape to be absolutely flat, which Bob and I have talked about, suggesting an infinite spatial expanse. Because of the limited variety of particles, an infinite spatial expanse infers infinitely repeating patterns of particles, which translates to infinite copies of us, an infinite number of myself spaced at great distances from each other across the infinite expanse of the universe. Sounds like an infinite nightmare. Well, I'm with you there, Matt. Am I understanding this correctly, or is infinity not as crazy as it sounds? My infinite thanks for your infinite consideration. And that is from Matt. Go ahead, somebody.
Oh, he's a character. This is the director of the Prescott Observatory out there in Arizona. And
very
just
cool.
A general good guy. But he's right. Infinity has been popping up lately because the study at Berkeley of 900,000 galaxies done about 8 years ago indicated that space has a flat topology, meaning there's no overall bending of it. Sure, there's a warpage around small, dense objects like individual galaxies or black holes, but overall, it's flat. And that indicates that the universe and the things in it, the gravitational objects within it, continue on, and that what is in we see locally must represent only the tiniest proportion of what there really is. And some cosmologists are now starting to talk about the overall universe being infinite in extent, which means the galaxies go on forever, and the we don't see any certainly decrease in them as we look towards the edge of the observable universe, which is about 13 billion light years away from us. But if it goes on forever, that's where the word infinity comes up. But it also arises in some of the theories in quantum theory and in others that suggest that if there are an infinite number of universes, if there really are beyond the observable one that we can see, then anything that can happen does happen, which would include endless copies of ourselves. And that's where infinity starts to get really weird, because does it really mean that? And is that really possible? And that's where I'll shut up and see what Valerie has to say.
All right, Valerie.
I think you tackled that question better than I would have tackled it, for sure. It's so hard to conceive, because we can only see so far, and then we can only understand out to what we can observe, and trying to extend our knowledge beyond that, that's where things get difficult. And I think what Bob said is perfect. It could be. We just don't know. It's hard to explain.
All right. And so if the universe is really infinite, then what we are seeing 0% of it, right? And therefore, we are proven that we really know nothing about anything. Isn't that true?
Basically.
All right.
When you say, is that true, that may be the strangest of all, because some have said, like the former, until recently, the head of the
American Astronomical Union, who is also a professor at Vassar, has said, Debbie Elmgreen, this is, she has said, well, yes, true, we can only observe a tiny percentage of the universe, but that'll keep us busy for a while, won't it?
Yeah.
And she's absolutely right. But
yep.
she slightly misspeaks when she says that if the universe is infinite, that we can only observe a tiny percentage, because any fraction of infinity is zero.
Right.
So if the universe is infinite, we don't observe a tiny fraction. We observe 0% of the universe.
Oh, thank God.
And in that case, how can we possibly trust
anything
we observe if our sample size is exactly 0%?
Thank God the show's almost over. Let's grab a couple of calls.
My brain hurts.
Rod in New Paltz. Rod, you're on.
Hey, hello, folks. How are you?
Good. Yeah.
Good.
Okay, simple question. We have a full moon here on the East Coast where I am and you folks are. On the West Coast, they also have a full moon. If why, and if why not?
Okay.
And I'll take it on the radio.
Thank you.
Okay?
Yep, you betcha. Go
well,
ahead.
Yeah, it has to be the same phase for everybody on Earth because, you know, we're talking about the moon's orbit around the Earth. So a full moon, it means that there's a syzygy, sun, Earth, moon, lined up in a straight line, and wherever you are on Earth, you're going to see the moon fully lit. It doesn't matter if you move from New York to L.A., it's still going to be the same.
Okay. Valerie?
Right. Well, the Earth is going to turn essentially underneath the moon, so one day for us, one full rotation, the moon is not going to shift that far in its orbit, so everybody around the world in one evening is approximately going to see a full moon if the full moon is up. And then the moon will be shifting in that time, and then we'll all see the next phase, and it just keeps going.
All right, Peter in Warren, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering if scientists have come up with any better propulsion systems. I know they were working on an ion engine not that long ago.
Yeah, so, I mean...
Yeah, we used it, actually. There was a space probe that used an ion engine. Right, Val?
Yeah, I was trying to think. It's the one that went to either Mercury or Venus. I forget which one. I want to say Mercury, but one of them recently did test out the ion propulsion system.
Don't they take a long time to pick up velocity, though?
Do you remember?
Yeah, there was that one, De Kamen's Vilt. I think that was the first
one
that used an ion engine.
Right.
Oh, you know what I think I was thinking of was solar sails. That might be the one I was thinking of. That's kind of the other technology that we're using. It's not an engine per se, but just kind of using the sun's light as energy to push a spacecraft forward.
All right, Peter, thank you very much for that one. And let's go to Kevin in Red Hook. Kevin, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering how frequently or infrequently the Aurora Borealis is visible from this area.
Well, my experience is about once a decade or so, we get a pretty nice display. And if we're lucky, it won't be near full moon, and it won't be a cloudy night. And some of those, the dice rolls badly for us on previous occasions. We last had a good one in the fall of 2001. And then the time before that was, oddly enough, just a year earlier, we had a very nice deep red display. And one of the Aurora experts, in the greatest ones in the world, told me that a deep red display is a once-in-a-lifetime phenomenon. Nonetheless, we saw a blood-red display in the autumn of 2000 that was bright enough to be seen from our whole area. Best display we've seen maybe in our lives here was in March 13th, I remember the date, in 1989, and that was an all-sky aurora seen from our whole region. Could be seen from all night long. It wasn't just in the north. It was overhead. It was in the entire sky. So, yes, we do get them.
All right. Good, Kevin?
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. All right, this email came in. We have a minute and 45 seconds to go, and so I think I'll spring this on both of you now. Will writes, could you explain quantum Darwinism, the current explanation of how objective reality occurs? Valerie.
Not in a minute and 40 seconds, so I'm going to pass it to Bob. Go.
that's the kind of thing that, unfortunately, the aspects of quantum mechanics are twofold. As a... it's not just a theory. If you actually use the math, it's very, very accurate and helpful
in solving a lot of our problems, and it's used routinely. But when it comes to the ideas behind it, including biocentrism and other ideas, you start to get very abstract and almost Eastern religion-ish in some of them. And then you get speculative, and you can say something or you could say it's opposite and argue either. Right, Val?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It gets really tricky once you get into the quantum world.
All right. Well, you did very well. You have 35 seconds. This one's from John. I recently heard a program on which spooky action at a distance was discussed. According to this idea, information can be transmitted faster than the speed of light. Since Einstein showed that nothing can travel that fast, apparently space may not be a basic feature of the universe, but an emergent feature of more basic characteristics. Any comments in 12 seconds?
Yeah, it could be. It could be. If the universe is another word for consciousness, and certainly the spooky action at a distance is simultaneous. This is in theory. There is the information from, let's say, one entangled particle to the other reaches it in real time. There is no delay at all. So it's not just limited to the speed of light. There is no delay whatsoever.
Right.
And that's not speculation. That's real.
All right, we are done. And, good thing, too. Bob Berman, thank you for being here, sir. Valerie Rapson, next time we talk to you, you'll be at Oneonta, right?
Yes, I will, but I'll continue to join the program going forward. Well, looking forward to it.
And congratulations, Valerie, on the new job.
Thank
Good
you.
Luck with it.
Well, thank you both, and we'll talk to you soon. Support comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Color, Light, and Atmosphere, rarely exhibited works by Grandma Moses, N.C. Wyeth, Whistler, and Innes through December 30th, arkellmuseum.org. And Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, accepting new clients, careersintransitionllc.com. Well, once again, thanks to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here today. Thank you for calling, and we got through all the calls today, even the weird ones, and so that was successful. These two will be back on with us again soon. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered by Matthew Plummer. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, oh yeah, a Food Friday favorite, Anissa Wahid of Tara Kitchen here. We'll talk Moroccan cuisine. That's tomorrow at 2 on Vox Pop. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.